Okay, everyone, welcome to another episode of Free for All, where conversations matter. Joining me today, a very distinguished guest here to discuss a very interesting topic relating to whether or not former President Trump should be disqualified from running for office again, or rather for holding office again. And joining me, as I mentioned, is a very distinguished guest. Let me give you a little bit of background on him, and I'm going to look away slightly so I don't get any of this wrong. My guest today is a professor of law at George Mason University and the B. Kenneth Simon Chair in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. His research focuses on constitutional law, property law, democratic theory, federalism, and migration rights. In other words, this is a smart guy, ladies and gentlemen. His writings have been cited in decisions by the United States Supreme Court, multiple state Supreme Courts and lower federal courts, and even the Supreme Court of Israel. You can find a lot of his work over at the Vala Conspiracy, which is a law blog hosted by our friends at Reason Magazine. Everyone, please welcome Professor Ilya Solman to the show. Professor, how are you today?
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no, it's always a pleasure to have someone of your experience and stature on the show to help us to make sense of what's going on in the world, Professor. So, just to dive right into it, obviously, former President Trump is running again for office for the 2024 presidential election. And obviously, a lot of controversy surrounding the president. He is the only president to be criminally indicted, I believe, in our nation's history. He is facing 91 felony charges in four criminal cases. Those would be cases in New York, Florida, Washington, and Georgia. Now, the case is specifically pertaining to whether or not he should be, quote, allowed to run for office, are the ones from Washington and Georgia. Now, what's often cited as the reason or the law under which he should be disqualified is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Is that correct? I'm a layman, please. I'm not a lawyer, so you'll have to indulge my fallacies.
So that is correct, but it's not quite true to say that the criminal cases against Trump have anything to do with disqualification. Being criminally convicted wouldn't by itself make him disqualified. On the other hand, in order to be disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, a criminal conviction actually is not necessary. So the criminal case against Trump and the possible disqualification are two separate things.
Oh, and see, that's a fascinating distinction you've made to a layman like myself. I have various friends who are lawyers, but I don't know so much that their practices involve constitutional law. So, and I think a lot of our listeners and viewers may find this a little contradictory, right? Like, for example, let's assume that President Trump is convicted on criminal charges, on felony charges. Is there the possibility, before we go into Section 3, is there the possibility that a convicted felon potentially behind bars could also be president of the United States?
Yeah, there is no law against that. You can say maybe that's an oversight by the framers of the Constitution, but there's no law either in the Constitution or even in a federal statute which says that you can't be a convicted criminal and yet also president of the United States. There's even no law which says that you can't be a convicted criminal serving a prison term and yet at the same time president of the United States. If that were to happen, it would create a very difficult situation as a practical matter, but as a purely legal matter, there's no law against it. And I would note there is a historical precedent of a mayor of Boston simultaneously being mayor and yet also in prison. There's no precedent, of course, of a president of the United States being in that situation, but Trump has broken a variety of other precedents. There is a chance he will end up breaking this one as well.
I was going to say, if anyone can figure out these otherwise unexplored constitutional crises and pragmatically put them to the test, I think it's been President Trump so far. But that's a very interesting case. And it's a very much a side note. Are you of the opinion that were he convicted and yet elected, that he could pardon himself? Again, I don't think there's any constitutional provision that says a president cannot pardon himself, correct?
A president cannot pardon himself on state charges because he can't pardon anybody for any state crimes. So if he gets convicted in the Georgia case or in a New York case, he could not pardon those offenses. In the federal cases, I think there's a debate among experts about whether a president could pardon himself or not. And, you know, I don't know. I think both sides have some strong arguments on that. The issue has never come up in the previous 200 or more years of American history, but this is another issue that should Trump be both convicted in the federal cases and also elected again, then, you know, that issue could arise.
Yeah, that's very interesting. One always wonders, as these potential constitutional crises are sort of brought to the forefront, why don't our legislatures address them to close, to, again, using layman terms, to close that loophole so that in the future we could say, hey, presidents perhaps should not be allowed to pardon themselves, or you can't be a sitting president and yet be behind bars, right? So I think it's interesting to me that we don't address those. Do you have any opinion on that? Why wouldn't legislatures address that?
So there are certainly a lot of things Congress fails to that it should do. In this case, this is not a problem Congress could fix, because if the president does have the power to pardon himself, then that's a power the Constitution grants to him, and Congress could not take it away, even any more than they can take away his power to be commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So if he does have that power to pardon himself, which obviously there's debate about, but if he does have it, it can only be removed by a constitutional amendment, which certainly Congress could try to get the ball rolling on, but then it would have to be ratified by 75% of the states. And as a practical matter, it would be difficult or impossible to pass that sort of an amendment, certainly within next year.
I agree with you, the constitutional amendment piece. But so interestingly enough, the mechanism would be that someone would have to, if in the event that a president tried to pardon himself, then someone with legal standing or an institution with legal standing would have to sue to so the Supreme Court could decide the constitutionality of it, correct?
So it might be hard to find somebody who had standing to sue under the technical grounds that the courts decide standing. If somebody with standing could be found, then I think an issue would go to a federal district court, but ultimately it might well end up in a court of appeals and perhaps in the Supreme Court as well. We're obviously talking hypotheticals on hypotheticals, in that Trump would have to be both convicted on a federal charge and elected, and then he would have to pardon himself, and then obviously somebody would have to challenge it. So it would raise, you know, a number of, you know, novel and difficult legal questions if that scenario were to come to pass.
Yeah, it is interesting to bounce those around, even if they're not necessarily practical scenarios. But okay, thank you for clearing that up a little bit. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is, given the Washington and the Georgia cases being the ones that pertain most to what we're talking about, I believe, let me read Section 3 of the 14th Amendment for those that may not be aware of the language. So I'll quickly read this. I'll try not to make any mistakes. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment states, "No person shall be a senator or a representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of these United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability." So clearly this was written post-Civil War, correct?
Yes.
And was intent. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And the immediate targets of it were former Confederates that Congress and the ratifiers of the Senate were afraid that Southern whites would elect former Confederates to federal office again, and they did not want that to happen. And so right. they enacted Section 3, but it's worded more generally, so it's not limited to the former Confederates.
Right. But the original intent, and the reason I say original intent is because this comes into under the discussion that we're about to have, was initially to prevent the Confederacy leadership from potentially holding federal office again, right? So, quick question. Has Section 3 of the 14th Amendment even attempted to be applied to anyone since the Civil War?
Yes. Most recently, it had been applied to a number of people who participated in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And in a couple cases, lower courts ruled that such people were indeed disqualified from holding office. I think there was a state office holder in New Mexico and another case. I'm trying to remember what state the other case was in, but I'm sort of blanking out. It was also applied, I think, in the early 20th century to a person who had been involved in efforts to undermine the war effort, perhaps during World War I. But it's true, until the events of January 6th, there had been very little in the way of attempts to use this section since the post-Civil War era, in part because there was very little in the way of opportunities to do so. Until
okay.
the events of the 2020.
Until recently, right, which is why we're here talking about this. Okay, now, again, help me out as a layman. If someone felt, and I believe Madison Cawthorn was potentially facing this in North Carolina, but it turned out it became a moot point when he lost the primary. But how does this act? What is the mechanism of Section 3 for it to be applied? Now, you said earlier you don't have to be convicted of a crime in order to be disqualified, say in a criminal court. So what is the mechanism here? Is it purely political? Is it along the lines of what we saw with the impeachment process with President Trump play out, where he was impeached, the Senate kind of said, hey, we're not going to convict him, you know, it's a waste of time type of thing. And it was clearly all political in nature. The rules of evidence didn't apply, you know, so on and so forth. The stuff we see on Law and Order did not come into play, right? So what would be potentially the mechanism of saying, we wish to disqualify President Trump under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment?
The mechanisms probably vary by state, because in the first instance, it's the states and their governments that determine who is eligible to be on the ballot. So a state official, such as a Secretary of State or another election official, can decide, you know, I conclude that Trump is ineligible to be on the ballot because, you know, he's disqualified from holding the office of the presidency. If that happens, then Trump could potentially challenge that in court, either in state court or in federal court. Perhaps initially it might have to be in state court, but eventually it could end up in federal court. And he could say, no, actually, you know, for various reasons we can talk about, you know, he could make the argument that he's not disqualified. And so there would be judicial review then of a decision that was initially made by an election official, which, by the way, is a fairly standard thing, that initially election officials make decisions, and then people who think that they acted illegally or made the wrong decision, they can go to court. Alternatively, and we already see this happening in a couple states, people can file lawsuits challenging Trump's eligibility to be on the ballot. And there might be procedural bars to doing that. You could say they don't have standing, but at the very least, Trump's opponents in the Republican primary, I think, have standing to sue if they wish to file lawsuits. And if Trump, as is likely, becomes the Republican general election candidate, his opponents in that election, most obviously President Biden, but any other opponents as well, would have the standing to file a lawsuit challenging his eligibility under Section 3. So there's a number of different ways this issue could be raised. I do think if you get either a state court or a federal court or a state official determination that he's ineligible, there's a good chance that this issue will ultimately get to the federal Supreme Court. There's a couple different ways that that can happen, but I think more likely than not, it will ultimately get there, and the federal Supreme Court will have to decide whether Trump is disqualified or not.
So that's very interesting. So as a mechanism, each individual state would have to make a determination. The Secretary of State of each individual state would have to make a determination whether or not to include President Trump on the state ballots, correct? So potentially you might have 50 challenges to his eligibility under Section 3. Is that correct?
In theory, that's possible. Different states have different procedures and different election systems. And a couple of secretaries of state have already said, I don't want to decide this issue on my own. I want to wait for a court decision. That's what the Secretary of State of New Hampshire, a Republican, has said. And that's relevant because obviously New Hampshire is an early primary that's coming up. But it's possible other Secretary of States, perhaps in blue or purple states, will make different decisions. And it's also possible in different states, there are sometimes different election officials that make decisions. It's also possible that people can bring lawsuits in state court where rules of standing and other procedural rules can be different than they are in federal court. There's already, I think, a lawsuit in Colorado, which is seeking to disqualify him in that state. There was an attempted lawsuit in Florida, which I think was dismissed on procedural grounds, but we will see more of these lawsuits. We will see determinations, I think, by state officials in different states. It is likely, though not certain, that at least some of them will decide that Trump is not eligible. And if that happens, then that increases the chance that the issue will eventually get to the Supreme Court.
Wow. That's a mouthful, and it's a lot to take in terms of, as I said before, I think most people who are not familiar with the intricacies of and the complexities of constitutional law just necessarily assume there's some mechanism in place where all this is sort of a checklist sort of thing, like natural born citizen, 35 years old, must have resided in the United States, right? These seem to me to be checklist items. Sure. Not an insurrectionist, not having engaged in rebellion against the U.S. government seems to me to be something that should be a checklist item, and that there should be almost pro forma mechanisms for this. But I see the point where it's not a federal case, since ballots are left to each sovereign state to set up how those ballots are set.
It's ultimately an issue of federal constitutional law, just like those other qualifications that you've mentioned. In the first instance, states decide who is on the ballot because we have a largely state-run system of elections, even for federal office. We saw that in play when Trump tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election, and there were different processes in different states. Unlike some countries in Europe and elsewhere, we do not have a single unified national election system. We have essentially 50 states plus the District of Columbia, they each have their own election procedures, which reach a bit different from each other. But there is a history of challenges to people's credentials under the Constitution. Ironically, one of the most recent instances of this was in 2016, when in the Republican primary, Trump was running against Senator Ted Cruz, and some of Trump's supporters filed lawsuits in a couple of different states arguing that Cruz was not a natural born citizen, because even though his parents actually were U.S. citizens, they were living in Canada at the time that he was born. And so they said, well, to be a natural born citizen, you have to be born on U.S. soil. Those cases were heard on the merits, and Trump supporters lost those cases. The courts ruled correctly, I think, that Cruz was a natural born citizen and eligible to run for the presidency. But I think that experience provides perhaps something of a model for what can happen now, that just as Trump supporters challenge Cruz's eligibility today, various opponents of Trump can challenge Trump's eligibility, albeit under a different constitutional provision. And this one, it has more potentially contestable issues than some of the others, like that you have to be 35 years old. But just that there's some vagueness about who counts as a natural born citizen. So there is some fuzziness on the issue of what it means to have an insurrection, what it means to aid it, and so on. And those issues would need to be resolved as part of the process of deciding whether Trump is eligible or not.
Right. Very good. I think you put it in such a way that even I understood it. So I appreciate you explaining that, Professor. Okay. So having talked about the mechanisms of Section 3, let's get right out with it. In the Washington case, those indictments were more directly tied to the events on January 6th in Washington. The speech by President Trump sort of inflaming or encouraging his supporters to march on the Capitol, the cries that to intimidate or force Vice President Pence into not certifying the results under, I would assume, false pretenses that he had the constitutional ability to do so. The Georgia cases being the Georgia indictments, rather, being state cases, all involve, I think, mostly around two big things. One is the phone call he placed where he, quote, asked for nearly 12,000 votes to be found in his favor of Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, also a Republican. Most people tend to forget that. And also violating the civil rights of the citizens of Georgia on some RICO statutes, I believe, state RICO statutes. So, in those cases, what is your general opinion? Did former President Trump engage in rebellion, insurrection, or an attempt to defraud the government and citizens regarding the events around January 6th?
So I should note, both the federal and state cases, they're not actually directly addressing the issue of whether he engaged in insurrection or supported insurrection or anything like that. Both of them are in slightly different ways about the issue of what happened in the days leading up to January 6th rather than January 6th itself, though there's a little bit on January 6th as well. And they primarily focus in various ways on two things. One is the scheme to replace the real electors in various states with fake electors, which leads to various both state and federal fraud charges of defrauding the United States or the state of Georgia. Second, trying to pressure Vice President Pence into illegally rejecting the electoral votes of various states. And then in the Georgia case, there's also some other charges about illegally accessing ballots and defrauding the state of Georgia and some other things. And you might say, how can he be charged in both Georgia and federal court for a lot of the same things? Well, the Supreme Court has long said that double jeopardy does not apply when there's two different sovereigns involved. In this case, the federal government and the state government. So you can essentially be charged with the same or similar crimes in both state and federal court, and there's not a double jeopardy. The Supreme Court reaffirmed that as recently as just 3 or 4 years ago, I think in a 7-2 decision with Justice Gorsuch and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissenting. I think Gorsuch and Ginsburg may well have been right in their dissent, but it doesn't really matter what I think. The Supreme Court majority resolved this issue, and therefore Trump can't get out of being charged in these cases. To make a long story short, not all of the criminal charges against him are issues that I have enough expertise on to fully comment on. For example, the Georgia RICO statute is very complicated, and I don't claim to be an expert on it. But I do think he is likely guilty on both many of the federal charges and also many of the state charges, because he very obviously, with various associates, did try to defraud the United States and fraudulently replace the real electors with fake ones. He also did very clearly try to pressure Pence into illegally rejecting the electoral votes and also pressure Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of Georgia, and other Georgia officials into falsifying the vote counts in those states. So I think it is very likely the case that he should be convicted on some of those charges. That is distinct, as I mentioned before, from the issue of whether he should be disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. I would argue he deserves to be disqualified even if he doesn't get convicted in any of these federal charges, because disqualification is a different proceeding. Among other things, it's a civil proceeding. It's not criminal. If you get disqualified in this way, you don't get sent to prison. You don't, right. You don't even get fined or anything like that. So you don't have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And some other procedures also don't apply that, you know, that would apply in a criminal case. So it's just like being disqualified for not being 35 years old or not being a natural born citizen, or
right.
Or if you've already served two terms, then you're not allowed to be president again under the 22nd Amendment. All of that does not require all of the full panoply of procedures that you would get in a criminal case, and the same thing applies here. But I would also concede that merely because he gets convicted, even perhaps on every one of those charges, that doesn't by itself prove he should be disqualified, because his defenders could still try to argue on various technical legal grounds that what he did was not an insurrection, or even if it was an insurrection, he wasn't closely enough connected to it, or someone even argued that the president is not, quote, an officer of the United States who is subject. But that's an argument that is irrelevant in criminal court, but does have relevance here, even though I think, you know, it's ultimately a pretty bad argument.
Right, right. So again, we're going back to that distinction between criminal and political.
It's criminal and civil. It's not necessarily criminal.
I'm sorry. You're right. Criminal and civil. I apologize. Yes. Criminal and civil, the difference between the two. So, and again, very interesting. Is it possible that any decisions that come from the criminal proceedings, would they, and again, forgive me if I'm using the wrong terminology, would they be admissible in the civil proceedings to disqualify him? Or are they allowed to be taken into consideration?
Possibly. I think there might be two ways in which they might be relevant. First, evidence that comes up in the criminal cases could potentially be relevant in the disqualification case as well. Evidence of Trump's support for the attack on the Capitol, his efforts to overturn the result of the election and stay in power and so forth. I think all of that is pretty obviously relevant. And to the extent that that evidence may be revealed by criminal investigators or by the January 6th commission or by other means, I think it could be entered into evidence in a court case, on the disqualification issue. Secondly, depending on what courts decide about the meaning of insurrection and other such questions, they could conclude that that while a criminal conviction doesn't by itself prove that Trump should be disqualified, that it's relevant evidence supporting the notion that he should be. So the two proceedings could interact in that way. There are obviously two of the criminal case against Trump that have little or no connection to the mm-hmm. attempt to overturn the election. The one dealing with classified documents, and then the one dealing with like the weird payoff to his mistress
in
New York.
Right,
those proceedings, I think have little, if any, relevance to disqualification, right. But the other two perhaps do.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. I agree with you. So to this objection that you kind of noted, I've read some articles by your colleague, say at The Reason or the Volokh Conspiracy blog, that no matter how you feel about Trump, either if you're a libertarian or if you're a supporter of Trump's or whatever, that he is not technically, I've seen the argument that he's not technically an officer of the United States, and that Section 3 does not explicitly name the president and the vice president as being those folks that would be disqualified if they did engage in insurrection. Do you agree with that, or do you find validity in that position?
I think it's a really bad argument. So first, the whole idea is inherently implausible and ridiculous. What it's basically saying, if you take it seriously, is that under Section 3, anybody who held virtually any other federal or state office, if they engage in insurrection, they would then be disqualified in the future, except for the person who held the highest office in the land, the presidency. So I grant sometimes, as Charles Dickens said, sometimes the law can be an ass. And so occasionally the law might compel us to accept some utterly ridiculous conclusions. But at the same time, if you're arguing that the law has this ridiculous implication, at the very least, you got to meet a high burden of proof. And the supporters of this claim that he's not an officer of the United States, they just come nowhere near meeting that. First, if you look at the discussions in Congress about Section 3, it was in fact said by a number of the framers that the president would be included. Second, if you just think about it in terms of what would sort of the ordinary reader of the words think at the time in 1868, right. It would be reasonable to assume that when they say all officers of the United States, that the president would in fact be included. That seems reasonable and intuitive, that the guy who is the highest ranking officer in the military, the commander in chief of the armed forces, also the highest ranking civil official, that person is in fact an officer of the United States. So if you're an originalist who says what matters is the original meaning understood by sort of ordinary readers, I think that pretty obviously would be the result. The argument that they try to make is they try to reason not so much from the text of Section 3, where there's no indication that the president is included, but rather from things that are in the original Constitution, where they say, well, if the president counts as an officer there, then you get certain weird results. Like, for instance, there's a provision which says, you know, the president has to commission all officers of the United States. And my answer to that is that he, in fact, commissions himself, too, by taking the presidential oath. It's a different procedure than the one by which he commissions, say, members of the military or the like, but it's ultimately the same kind of thing. There's other provisions of the original Constitution where maybe there would be awkwardness if the term officer of the United States includes the president. I think this is still less awkward and stupid than if we conclude Section 2 ridiculously excludes the president. But the other thing that I would say is that the way a term was used in 1868 can sometimes be different than the way it was used 80 years earlier in the original Constitution. So even right. if in certain places in the original 1787 Constitution, there may be references to officers of the United States that don't include the president, that ain't true in Section 3. And it's Section 3 that we're concerned about in this particular instance. There are other technical points about this. If people are interested, I went over this in more detail in a piece on the Vola Conspiracy blog just a couple weeks ago on September 16th.
Okay. And we'll definitely link out to that as part of this episode. It occurred to me, I could be wrong about this, but when the president takes the oath, doesn't he say to isn't there an reference to the office of the president of yes. the presidency?
So,
yes.
So another weakness in this argument is that the Constitution, both in the oath and elsewhere, refers to the presidency as an office. So essentially right. on this theory, the president is a person who holds an office, but not an officer. And I grant you can try to make this argument with respect to members of Congress, and there's reason to think that maybe members of Congress are not officers of the United States, but that's because an officer in lay understanding is a person who has the power to issue orders and commands, and members of Congress, by and large, do not do that. Like an individual member of Congress cannot issue orders to anybody, whereas a person who's an official in the executive branch or an officer in the military and the like, they do in fact issue orders. And so those people are officers in a sort of ordinary linguistic sense, in a way that at least arguably may be members of Congress or not, though it's worth noting that members of Congress are actually specifically listed among the people covered by Section 3.
Right.
With the president, he's not listed because I think the framers assume he counts as an officer, whereas with the members of Congress, there linguistically it's a little bit less clear whether you could call them officers or not. And I think this whole officer argument is the kind of thing that makes people hate lawyers, right? That stereotypically, you know, I include myself in this, I'm a lawyer, we're viewed as these people who twist words and language away from basic common sense and towards things that are ridiculous and stupid. And sometimes it is actually reasonable to have technical meanings of words where you need a lawyer to interpret it. They're different from the way ordinary people use those words. Like there's some place where there's technical legal language that's different from ordinary language. And I teach property law. That comes up all the time. But there's no evidence that in Section 3, officer of the United States is some weird technical legal phrase. And it certainly was not a technical legal phrase that was generally used at the time in a way that excluded the president and in a way that was intended to be embodied in Section 3.
Right, right. Well, you certainly present it in a way. I mean, as you said, as a layperson reading it, I'm like, there's no way they meant to exclude the president, right? And the vice president for that matter. But as you said, you know, there's a reason I'm not a lawyer. And one of them is I get confused very easily. So that's why I need smart people like yourself to explain it to me so I can understand it a little bit better. All right. Now, in terms of if you're of the opinion that President Trump should be disqualified, once again, what would be your main reason for disqualifying him? Not for insurrection, but for fraud? Is that your personal opinion? Would that be the case?
I don't think the terms of the amendment allow a person to be disqualified for fraud. What they do is allow for him to be disqualified for first engaging in insurrection and second for providing aid and comfort to enemies of the United States. Mm. And that leads us to what I think are the more difficult issues involved here, which is, and here, unlike in the case of the officer of the United States theory, Trump's defenders do, I admit, have some non-completely frivolous arguments on these issues. So one issue is whether the January 6th attack really was an insurrection. I believe that it was because they were trying to keep in power a person who under the Constitution was no longer entitled to it, or rather would not be entitled to it after another two weeks had passed. And so to my mind, overturning the constitutional order of succession by force and installing someone as president who actually was not legally entitled to office, that I believe that qualifies as an insurrection, though there is an argument the other way. A second issue is where you can say Trump wasn't actually the one who stormed the Capitol. You know, was he sufficiently connected to it? And there, I think his encouragement of violence, both in the immediately before the attack and for some weeks previously in various statements that he had made, plus his efforts during the attack to call up various senators and representatives to use the attack as leverage against them to try to pressure them into refusing to certify the results, his attempt to encourage the attack in various ways, plus to use it as leverage, I think that qualifies as him being engaged in an insurrection. And at the very least, it qualifies him as having aided or given aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States, in this case, domestic enemies, the people who are trying to use force to overturn the election. So I think there is a good case on that. There are also some scholars who say that insurrection should be defined much more broadly than that. And the now well-known article by Will Bode and Michael Paulson, two prominent conservative originalist legal scholars, they actually say that insurrection involves any forcible effort or even fraudulent effort to try to impede the enforcement of a federal law. I'm not sure we need to go that far. And I think a definition that broad would be problematic in various ways. But what happened on January 6th and the events leading up to it was an insurrection in the narrower sense of trying to seize the powers of government and transfer them to a person who wasn't legally entitled to them, namely Donald Trump, who would have ceased to be legally entitled after January 20th when his term ended. So I don't think you need an ultra broad definition of insurrection, though there is some evidence that a broad definition of insurrection was intended by the framers of the 14th Amendment. But I don't think you need to adopt an extremely broad one in order to disqualify Trump.
It's interesting that in your explanation just now, you could almost hear the objections of some Trump supporters or even non-Trump supporters, some libertarians, and this is a libertarian show, so we might as well tie it into libertarians, right?
So I'm more than happy.
There you go. Yeah. it's important to me that I did not hear you really tie this in to the content of his speeches, the content of his positions, meaning this does not sound to me, as some claim, that this is an infringement of President Trump's First Amendment rights. This is not him just going out there and, even if you take the worst position of he's knowingly lying, he's knowingly making statements he knows to be false, even if you take that worst position all the way to the range of he truly believed he won the election. He was convinced by his aides and his circle of advisors that Pence could reject, you know, even so anywhere on that broad spectrum, that's really not the position of either the criminal cases or even the potential situation where he gets disqualified, because it's not the speech itself. It's the actions in association with the speech to prevent the transfer of power, correct?
So if Trump had simply limited himself to saying, you know, I actually won the election and just made speeches to that effect, that would have been a very bad thing. It by itself would almost certainly not have led to criminal charges. You can make an argument about whether it could qualify as aiding or an insurrection by itself or the like. But in this case, we don't have to do that. We don't have to say that's merely speaking out about the election either leads to criminal liability, which it surely would not, or if it did, the criminal statute would be unconstitutional in that instance. The speech is relevant only insofar as it shows his motives for engaging in things which went beyond speech, such as the efforts to insinuate the fake electors and replace the real ones with them, to pressure Pence, and to encourage the attack on the Capitol, and then use it as leverage, which he clearly did try to use it as leverage, to try to get the senators and representatives to reject the vote count. And it is these actions which I think justify his disqualification and also justify him being convicted on at least some criminal charges, though perhaps not all. But I do want to make clear that he is not being charged for speaking out against the election result. He is not being charged for believing, if he did in fact believe, that he won the election. And there's a lot of evidence, in fact, that he did not believe it and he was lying. But if he did believe it, that itself is not a crime. Even lying about the election is not by itself a crime if he did that. And neither of those things by themselves probably could lead to disqualification under Section 3. What does lead to disqualification, I think, is the actions that I mentioned earlier, of which the speech was in a certain sense a component, but almost any criminal conspiracy or insurrection does involve some speech. The insurrection of the Confederacy, of course, during the Civil War began with people making speeches in favor of secession and votes to secede by Southern state conventions and so on. Similarly, any, you know, criminal conspiracy is like that. You know, when we're talking about speech, a lot depends on its context and whether the context is one where it's clear that the people are plotting an action as opposed to merely expressing an opinion. You know, like if I say Joe Schmo is a terrible person, deserves to die, that's probably just me expressing an opinion. You know, whereas if a mob boss tells one of his underlings, you know, it would be great if Joe got whacked because I don't want to see Joe around anymore. In that context, that looks like an order to commit murder. And even though it is in and of itself just a speech, still the mob boss could be convicted in that situation, especially if it turns out that the underling really did go out and whack Joe or attempt to do so.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the mob sort of analogy, because that's the first thing that popped into my, especially in the Georgia case with that phone call that we all listened to. You know, you never hear Trump say, I want you to fraudulently come up with 12,000 votes for me, right? Or that I want you to disqualify 12,000 mail-in ballots for Biden. But the analogy I always use is, you know, John Gotti never said, go blow his brains out. He used to say, I don't want to see him no more, or make him disappear, or whatever, right? So, and people still understood the context of those statements in conjunction with the activity of a person disappearing or being killed or whatever, right? Yeah. So I certainly understand that.
And I think it's important to recognize that Trump's defenders say, well, maybe he just wanted know, allegations of fraud to be fairly looked into. But I think if you look at the transcript or the audio of that conversation, it just doesn't make sense interpreted that way.
No.
First, he says the specific number 11,780 votes, which just happens to be the exact number that he would have needed to overcome Biden's margin
right.
in Georgia. Second, by that time, there already had been multiple recounts and investigations, including those overseen by Republican officials like Raffensperger. And Raffensperger had earlier in the same call explained to Trump that, you know, there was no evidence of fraud, certainly not on the scale that would have been necessary to create an almost 12,000 vote margin. So it's and Trump, you know, simply just didn't care about that. So it's pretty obvious that when Trump says, get me the 11,780 votes, he wants that number of votes and does not care, you know, whether it's legal or not. If he were merely saying, let's make sure that everything is on the up and up, then he certainly would not be saying, give me the exact number of votes.
You're right.
Happen to need to overturn the person's lead. So as with the John Gotti example that you mentioned, context really matters and the precise nature of what was said was matters. And I think if you listen to that tape in context, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that he was pressuring Raffensperger to falsify the vote results.
Right. Now, given what you we've just talked about, is there any potential for any senators or congresspeople who supported Trump in his allegations to be similarly disqualified? Or are they actually, I'm thinking of, say, of Hawley or somebody like that, or are they considered to be in on it in the parlance? Or do you feel in their case, it really is just an expression of free speech that is not criminal and really wouldn't be sort of underlying any potential disqualification of people like that?
So I think at the very least, any case against those people, based on what we currently know, would be considerably weaker than the case against Trump, that at least as far as we know, those people were not involved for weeks in the scheme to generate fake electors and the like, pressure Pence and so on. You could say that, and it's also the case that those who voted to reject the certain electoral votes, well, I think they made a terrible decision. That is an action that they're legally entitled to under the Constitution. So it would at the very least be hard to argue that that can lead to Section 3 disqualification. With Hawley, there's also him giving the thumbs up sign to the, you know, to the rioters.
Rioters, yeah.
Before they fully started to riot. So you could try to make out a case against Hawley, but at the very least, it would be much more of a stretch than the case against Trump. Though perhaps, you know, evidence could emerge of some of these members being more involved in the plot than we currently know. But based on what is currently known, or at least what I currently know, any case against them would be, at the very least, be much weaker than the case against
Trump. Right. I tend to agree with that position, especially given what we know, like you said, unless there was somebody who had plotted with Trump and his co-conspirators, co-indictees. I don't know what the proper phrase is, but
in Georgia case, they're actually indicted co-conspirators because a lot of these other people were in fact indicted. In the federal case, they're so far unindicted co-conspirators, much like Richard Nixon was in the Watergate case, but it is likely that in the future they will in fact become indicted co-conspirators. It's just that Jack Smith, the special counsel, has decided he wants to prosecute Trump separately from the others, whereas in Georgia, the prosecutor there made the opposite decision that she would like to prosecute everybody together.
Together, yeah. So, and now, we've talked about, and I'm sure not to the depth required, but I mean, just for layman's purposes, we've talked about the mechanisms of Section 3, whether or not you feel Trump should be disqualified. But let me ask you this. Do you feel there's any element? What about Trump supporters who say this is all a political witch hunt, much like Trump himself is out stumping for right now? This is all a political witch hunt. Look at the timing of this. Why are these indictments coming at really as we're heading into the 2024 election, the primary season? Couldn't this have done sooner? Of course, it's political because there's a Democrat in office. It of course, it's political because the Biden crime family or the criminal Clintons or lying Hillary or whoever, they themselves have not been disqualified. Look at their crimes, et cetera, et cetera. What's your feeling that, given everything else you've said, that the motivations for this are purely political and that the legal system is being weaponized? You hear that term a lot.
I think there's several different arguments there. First, you can argue, yes, various Democratic politicians have political motives. That political motives almost always exist, anything involving presidents or contenders to presidency and the like. But that does not mean that Trump isn't guilty or that he doesn't deserve to be disqualified. The fact that there are people who have political motives for wanting to be convicted or for disqualifying him doesn't mean that he does not, in fact, deserve to have those things happen. I would add,
just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean people aren't out to kill me, right?
And also it doesn't mean that they don't have a good reason to want you dead, if you want to extend the analogy further.
Yeah, there you go.
If any Democratic president had done anything remotely similar to the kinds of things that Trump had done, then Republicans would be rightly out for blood and would want him both convicted and disqualified. And Democrats are entitled to feel that way here. I myself am not a Democrat. I don't like the Democratic Party. I have never voted for them except in cases when they are less reasonable compared to Trump. Only Trump has made them great again in my eyes. Really not great again, just less less ungreat than Trump himself is, if you want to prove. But nonetheless, the fact that people have political motives doesn't prove that he doesn't deserve to be prosecuted or disqualified. Second, as to timing, yes, it might have been better if charges were brought sooner, though in that event, Trump supporters would complain, well, they're being brought before the election, so as to try to destroy him before the election. So they would just have a different complaint about timing then. But it's worth noting that the reason why the charges took longer to bring than they might have been in some other cases, because investigators took longer to cross their T's and dot their I's, and also because as a former president, he actually got somewhat more favorable treatment from investigators and from prosecutors than an ordinary person might have. So for example, if an ordinary person had held on to classified documents in a way that Trump didn't refuse to return them, that person would have been charged very quickly. It's only because he's a former president that a special counsel was appointed, and the special counsel did further investigation, who I can only then charge them. And the same thing, I think, with the January 6th charges, that they wanted to go into greater depth of investigation, amass more evidence, precisely because he's a former president. I would add also that if he were not a former president, there's a good chance that that he might be subject to pretrial detention right now, or at the very least required to post a high amount of bail. So in that respect, also, he's being treated more favorably because of who he is than less. I'm not saying, by the way, that he should be in pretrial detention, but the only reason why I think he should not is because I generally think that pretrial detention is overused in this country, and therefore I don't want to make an exception to my general principles on that just because, he's a former president and he's, a horribly awful person who I would like to be convicted. I say the same thing when ordinary people are subject to pretrial detention, and it's troubling to me that people can be in pretrial detention for weeks or months, even without actually having been convicted of anything. That's very problematic. That's a whole separate discussion that we can have. There's also the argument, well, what about, bad things that Biden or Hillary Clinton or others have done? I would say none of those things, even if proven to be true, like let's say, for instance, Biden really was complicit in Hunter Biden's various schemes to enrich himself and that Biden had taken bribes, that would be a bad thing for which Biden would deserve to be prosecuted. It is not on par with Trump's attempts to overthrow the Constitution and keep himself in power after losing an election. It's worth noting also that just as there is a special counsel that investigated and eventually brought charges against Trump with regard to the classified documents, there is actually a separate special counsel, Robert Hur, a U.S. attorney who was originally appointed by Trump, who is investigating the Biden classified documents case, which on the surface to me seems less egregious than the Trump case, but Hur is investigating it. Should he conclude that Biden acted illegally in the same egregious way that Trump did, and her has every incentive to bring those charges. Finally, on Hillary Clinton, if you believe that she deserved to be prosecuted for what she did with the email servers and the like, well, the first group to blame for not doing that is the Trump administration, who had 4 years during which they could have brought those charges if they had thought that they were serious enough to warrant bringing them. Trump and his attorneys general are as much to blame as anyone for not bringing those charges if you think they should have been brought. And, you know, maybe right. They should have, but it's certainly, again, not nearly as serious a crime or as much a threat to the Republic as the things that Trump did. So I'm entirely willing to admit there are various corrupt Democratic politicians out there. One of them, Senator Bob Menendez, is actually under indictment right now, and there's a good chance that he will be convicted. But the fact that Democrats do bad things or that Democratic politicians may be hypocrites and so on, all that is true. It in no way exonerates Trump or suggests he doesn't deserve to be prosecuted and disqualified for his much worse conduct.
I agree with you. And to be honest with you, I've always found it nonsensical when anyone justifies their bad behavior by saying, I'm emulating my opponent's bad behavior. I've never understood why that should hold water with anyone, because, you know, a reasonable person would say, why would I vote for a Republican who emulates a Democrat if my whole point is to not have Democrats in office, right? It seems to me to be illogical, but I agree with you on that. And okay, so lastly, you're a libertarian, I'm a libertarian. Let me ask you about what, to me personally, I find some of the libertarian positions on the whole whether or not Trump should be disqualified a little confusing. Sure. I'm not talking about what I would call principled libertarians, say, not the ones who join the party just long enough to vote for Trump in a different party line, right? What would you say is the proper libertarian response to this whole situation? So, for example, I do understand the concern that this might be a political witch hunt, and that we don't want a quote banana republic or something of that sort, where the way you get rid of your political opponent from challenging your supremacy is by throwing them in jail, by criminalizing their speech, right? So I understand that concern. Libertarians being naturally anti-authoritarian and for the most part anti-large government, unless you're an anarchist, of course, right? But it also seems to me that why would libertarians excuse criminal behavior in support of anti-government positioning? It seems a little confusing to me. Your opinions on that, if you don't mind.
So I think, obviously, there are different libertarians with different positions on this. Some of those who are sympathetic to Trump's side of this case, or at least against disqualifying him or prosecuting him, I think are just under the mistaken impression that this is all about speech. And that just isn't true. We've covered that already. Why that isn't true? If it were true, I would be the first to say that he should not be punished for it. And you know, there are lots of other people out there who said Trump won the election and who said stupid things about it and who are not being prosecuted. And if any attempt was made to prosecute them, you know, I would say, you know, they should not be. On the other hand, I think unless you're a pure anarchist, libertarians should prefer some form of democratic government with stable and peaceful transition of power to undemocratic government where the person who loses an election can stay in power by use of force and fraud. That's even if that's not bad in itself from a libertarian point of view, it is likely to be bad in its extended consequences because on the whole, with rare exceptions, authoritarian states are worse for libertarian values, liberty, property rights, and so forth than democratic governments, even though democratic governments certainly have serious flaws as well. Finally, I think there is a legitimate libertarian concern about the way Section 3 is set up, which I haven't seen anyone else mention, but I have mentioned in my article on lawfare, which is otherwise sympathetic to going after Trump. And that is that the Section 3 says anyone who engaged in insurrection is disqualified and it doesn't distinguish between insurrections for unjust causes and insurrections for just causes. I think Trump's case is clearly an unjust cause, keeping someone in power who had lost an election and keeping somebody who's certainly not advancing libertarian principles at all by his policies either. He did an enormous amount of harm from a libertarian standpoint, far outweighing any good that he did in a few issues. But certainly there have been insurrections in American history and in other countries which are for just causes. For example, John Brown's insurrection against slavery, which happened just before the Civil War. I think that would qualify as an insurrection under Section 3. But I also think it was an insurrection for a just cause, and ideally a person who rebelled for the purpose of overthrowing slavery should not be disqualified. And of course, there is an irony that the United States was founded by people who engage in insurrection against the British Empire. What they did was probably almost certainly illegal under the laws of the British Parliament at the time. Now, those people, had they lived long enough, would not have been disqualified under Section 3, because Section 3 only applies to insurrection against the United States, not insurrection against Britain.
Right.
But even so, the issue of the possibility of just insurrections, it is one that to some extent weighs on me and does give me some qualms about the way Section 3 is generally structured, but it is in the Constitution, and at the very least, it should enable us to disqualify people who engage in insurrection for clearly unjust purposes. And while there is a risk that at some point in time, people who engage in insurrection for good reason would also be disqualified, on balance, I think that risk is worth paying, though in an ideally drafted constitution, we would probably try to make distinctions between different types of insurrections, though that might not be easy to do in a sort of legal way, using legal language that would be clear and readily enforceable.
What's interesting is regarding your point between just and unjust insurrection, wouldn't that just be a case of the victors getting to write the history books in that case? It really becomes a post-insurrection.
Section 3 is indeed a case of the victors writing the history. Obviously, the people who won the Civil War enacted the post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, including Section 3. And as I pointed out in one of my pieces on this, the Confederates actually thought not only that they had a just cause, but that they were acting entirely legally, because they believed states had a right to secede. So Jefferson Davis, who went on to become president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, who was their vice president, said, well, we're just acting legally. The side that's undermining the Constitution is actually the Union suppressing the right to secession. But the 14th Amendment, including Section 3, obviously rejects that view and embodies the view that the Confederates were in fact insurrectionists, even if they thought otherwise. That's actually relevant here, because some defenders of Trump say, well, he and his supporters, they weren't engaged in insurrections. They thought that they were helping the legitimately elected president reverse a fraud. And I think the answer is that by that theory, the Confederates weren't insurrectionists either, because many of them honestly believed they were just exercising a legal right to secession. And if you interpret Section 3 in a way under which the Confederates, at least many of them like Jefferson Davis, the leader of the whole thing, were not insurrectionists, then you clearly have a wrong interpretation of Section 3. But it is Section 3 and the entire 14th Amendment is to some extent the victors writing the history. Fortunately, in that instance, I think the right side won, in that what you might say about the constitutional issue of secession, the reason why the Confederates tried to secede was to promote the horrific, evil institution of slavery. And it was therefore good that they were defeated, even though there are cases in history in other countries where secessionist movements arose for just causes and where the secession
qualified. Right. Wow, what an interesting conversation.
As a libertarian, I certainly would not say secession is never justified. I do think it was unjustified in this case for that particular cause.
Right. And look, libertarians have always, one of the things you'll hear a libertarian always say is, the whole Thomas Jefferson, the fruit of the tree of liberty must be replenished by the blood of patriots and tyrants on occasion. Right. So every whatever it was, 20, 25 years. So we libertarians, if you're a real libertarian, you do have that streak in you where you're like, hey, at any point, we should have the right to overthrow our government when it becomes so unjust and deprives us of our inalienable rights. So I intellectually I'm sympathetic to that, but at the same time I do recognize that a failed revolution, a failed insurrection, you're not going to get any justice from the people who held on to power. So there is always that risk. But all right, Professor Ilya Soman, thank you so much for joining us today on Free for All to discuss this issue. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Please let the viewers and listeners know where they can find some of your work and if you have any social media handles or anything that our viewers can follow.
Sure. So as you mentioned before, a lot of my work is on the VOLOK conspiracy blog website, VOLOKH, which is at The Reason. You can also find a lot of my work just by Googling my name, and I have my own website. We can see a lot of my articles. And of relevance here, I published an article at the Lawfare website about some of these sort of more practical arguments back and forth about Section 3 disqualification and how, and parallels with situations in other countries where they have imposed constraints on office holding to keep out people who are seen as threats to liberal democratic values. And I also there also go into that issue of just versus unjust insurrections as well.
Fantastic. And I can testify to the fact of your articles really being something that I make a point of reading. They're informative and yet they're accessible, I think, to most people, even if like myself, you're not a lawyer. So Professor Soman, thank you so much for joining us once again. You have been watching an episode of Free for All right here on grumblingsmedia.com. Follow us on all the social media platforms. You could see them on the screen right there. And until next time, when we'll have another interesting guest to discuss issues pertaining to libertarians and libertarianism. This has been Big John. Catch you all next time.
Thank you for having me.